We are on page 3 as we begin this evening and continue the study of Satan and demons. I'm dealing with Satan at the moment. And we introduced him. He is, again, he's one of our enemies. He's a very crafty enemy. And he does relate to one of our other enemies. It's the other enemy is his baby, is the world system. And between those two and the flesh, we do have quite a spiritual conflict oftentimes that goes on. And so we do need to know the enemy. And this isn't the Christian life course, but we do want to notice we will be noticing one of our enemies though, and what he does. So with that, on page 3, let's go ahead and look to the Lord and we'll get started. Our Father, we're grateful again for your goodness to us and your grace and for your provisions under grace, whereby we can have victory over Satan and the world system and our flesh. We're thankful again for those provisions. We're thankful that as we live in this world and with the influences of the enemies, we're thankful that when it comes to Satan he can't really touch us. He can put thoughts in our mind from outside, and he can attack us in that way, and he does. But we're thankful that the one who's in us, your son, that he is greater than the one who's in the world, that is Satan. And so that we do have the potential to have victory. So again, might we be encouraged as we think of these things, as we do move into the study this evening. Again, might the Spirit guide our thoughts as we consider this crafty enemy that we all face as we live in this world. And so we're thankful again for your provisions. Amen. Okay, we got down to about letter D. And as we considered Satan last week, we saw that he is a cherub. And we did some work in Ezekiel chapter 28. We'll come back to Ezekiel 28 this evening, and we'll spend some more time looking at Satan. He is a cherub. We notice that he's a cherub with one face and two wings. He's of the highest rank of spirit beings, and so he was the highest in the highest ranking of God's created beings. And we spent some time noting last week that he was created, and that we saw here in Ezekiel 28. And we saw that at the end of verse 13, it says, in the day that thou was created. And so he was created, a created being. And so he was created, a spirit being. And so he doesn't have a body. Doesn't have a soul, but he does. He is spirit, and he is a rational being, but he is a created rational being. It's a spirit being. And though he doesn't, you do have descriptions of them with wings and things. They're spirit. We can't see them, in other words. And so they don't have flesh and blood like we do, but they are different ranks, and they are represented. We see the representatives of the highest ranking cherubs in the tabernacle first and in the temple. And you have the picture described of them around the inside of the tabernacle and temple. And in the Holy of Holies in particular, you had the cherubim with their wings overshadowing the so-called mercy seat, the propitiatory, the place of satisfaction when the blood was offered on the altar. And so Satan, he was one of the highest ranking ones. And we looked at some things, some characteristics about him, and we saw last time that he was wise, that he was, his wisdom corrupted him because of his beauty, though. His wisdom, he was wise, but he was beautiful. And so he was corrupted in his wisdom. And so he's smart. He's smarter than we are, and he's much more powerful than we are. But yet we do have a relationship to the one who is almighty, and to the Son of God who has conquered Satan. And so we do have that, we have the potential, though we don't put Satan down. We don't take him lightly. There are a lot of jokes about Satan, but he's not a joking subject. He's not a joking person. He's not the kind of person you would joke about. We do take him seriously. And the moment we don't take him seriously, we might set ourselves up to be open to his attacks anyway. But as we begin, we're coming back to verse 14, and we see that he was the cherub that covers. And it says that he was the cherub that covers. It says, I'm going to just retranslate that. Thou art, looking at the individual, but rather than you are, he says you were, we would supply here, because this is what he was. You were the anointed cherub. And so that's what he used to be when he's addressed here. But he says you were, Ezekiel says, the anointed cherub that covereth. And so when you look at the word covereth here, you've probably heard of the Jewish feast of tabernacles, tents, Sukkoth. But it comes from that root of something, of a covering. But it does have the idea of overshadowing, a screen. And so he was the overshadowing cherub. And when he, as the overshadowing cherub, he was above all the other cherubs that were created. And so he was the highest of the cherubs. He's the only one who was an overshadowing cherub. And we could see that he was very wise and very beautiful when it came to God's creation and his created beings. And so he is the cherub that covers. And so he is the overshadowing cherub. And we'll notice that term again down in verse 16, where down towards the end of the verse, after his fall, it says, I will destroy thee, O covering or overshadowing cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. And so he's going to be kicked out of the place where he was when he was created, and where he overshadowed. We'll notice some of those things as we move on here. Now, we'll finish off verse 14, though, and verse 16. But notice where he was as the one overshadowing, what he did. He said, and I have set thee, verse 14, I have set thee so. And so God set him as the overshadowing cherub. Thou wast upon the holy mountain of God. Thou hast walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire. And so he was upon the mountain of God. Now, when we look at mountain here, this is not going to be a physical mountain. We'll comment on that when we get to the next page. But I do have it in the next point. He was on the mountain of God, though, God's government. And so a mountain can be a government. I have some references on the next page that deal with that. Let's go back to the second psalm, and we'll just give one illustration now. It's not in your notes, but you can jot it down if you want, but it's Psalm chapter 2, not chapter 2. Psalms don't come in chapters, they come in psalms. I always have to correct in homiletics, when somebody's in the psalms, we often have to always correct them. When we come to the second psalm, you'll notice verse 6. Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill, or my holy mountain. It's the word for mountain, my holy mountain of Zion. And so he was set upon the holy mountain of Zion. And this is a place of elevation, but this is where his rule will be. And it looks at rule and looks at government. And we'll see that it's used of kingdoms. It represents kingdoms and rule. And so he was set upon the holy mountain, the mountain of God's holiness, we could say, but a place where God ruled for, it's this kingdom. And so it looks at a kingdom as the mountain here. It's not just a physical mountain. And so he was the overshadowing. He was overshadowing on the Mount of God, that is, over the government of God. And it says that he was over the earth. The earth was his stewardship. He was in charge, and he was the one who was in charge of the, you could say, over the universe at this time, out of God's created beings. He was the highest cherub, and out of the spirit beings, he was the highest rank, which was a cherub. The cherubim were the highest, and then he was the highest of the cherubim. So he was the highest cherub, and he was overshadowed, but he was over the earth. And so this is where he was. As we'll take note, though, he was in a garden down the page. I won't jump there now, but he was over the earth, and he was upon the earth. And so from earth, he wants to raise his he wants to put his throne up higher than God's, we'll see. But as you look at this, he is on earth, though, and he was over other spirit beings. And so the spirit beings, where are the spirit beings? We noted last week, and let's go back and look at it again in Job 38. You have reference to the creation of the starry spaces. When the starry spaces were created in the heavens, and you had before Genesis 1:1, you had some creation that took place before. And so in Job 38, when God speaks to Job out of the whirlwind, he says, where are you, Job, when all these things took place? But then when you get down to verse 7, he says, when the morning stars sang together. And we would take this, the morning stars, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. And so when God was involved in the creation of the heavens and the earth, now there were places, there were stars, and the spirit beings would be those who occupied the stars. In fact, they're represented and referred to as stars later on. in when we get to Revelation, we'll take note of that. Later on, but he was over other spirit beings as the anointed, he was anointed cherub, the anointed cherub. He was the only one who was anointed. He was also the overshadowing. And so he overshadowed, he was over the God's created beings as spirit beings at this time. And so this is where he was. This was his position as the cherub that covers. Now, where was he after he was created? This takes us then back to Ezekiel 28. And we see it says that Satan was in the original Eden, the garden of God, before the original earth came to be without form and void. And so it says here in verse 13, thou hast been in Eden, the garden of God. Now, where was Adam placed when he was, after he was created? Well, it says God put him in a garden. He planted a garden and put him in east of Eden. We'll take a look at that. But it says, every precious stone was thy covering. Now, he was the overshadowing cherub, but notice he had a covering here. It's translated, he was the covering, the cherub that covereth. This is the same term here. He was overshadowed by some things here as a covering. And so thy covering, that you were overshadowed with the sardius, topaz, and the diamond, and the beryl, and the onyx, and the jasper, and the sapphire, and the emerald, and the carbuncle, and gold. The workmanship of thy tablets and of thy pipes was prepared in thee in the day that thou wast created. And so where was he when he was created? He was in a place that was referred to as Eden, but it's a garden. But notice the kind of garden this is. This is not a vegetative garden, but this is a rock garden, a mineral garden. And so he was created and placed in a garden, though he was in a garden on earth. I shouldn't say on earth, because that's where he's going to end up, but when he was created. But he was created, this is an Eden that preceded the Garden of Eden where Adam was created. And that's what we're saying. So we want to go back to Genesis for a moment. Keep your finger back here. We'll be right back here. But when we come to Genesis chapter 1, I want to take a look at that first. And, well, before we do that, let's go ahead and look at the garden concept over in chapter 2. And when you come to verse 8, it says, "And Jehovah God Elohim planted a garden eastward in Eden." So there was a place already referred to as Eden. And there he put Adam, whom he had fashioned. The word formed or fashioned. Now what he did with Adam, he put him in the garden. But in verse 15, it says, "And Jehovah Elohim took Adam, and he caused him to rest." And we pointed this out earlier, last quarter, that when he put him there, it's really the verb has the idea to cause to rest. But he was caused to rest into the Garden of Eden to dress it and to guard it, keep it, to guard it. And so he was in a garden. No, Adam was in a vegetable kind of a garden. And he could eat anything from any tree except for the one tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But this was in a garden with trees and vegetation. Now we come back over to chapter 1, and notice it says, "In a beginning." Now it says in the King James, and a lot of your English translations, they put a "the" there, the definite article. So but it's not there. It doesn't have the article here, so it's emphasizing a quality of a beginning. It's not the first beginning. And oftentimes you will see when you find the word beginning in the New Testament even, you find it quite frequently in 1 John, and for instance, and also in John 1:1, you have inequality of a beginning, in any beginning. That's when the eternal word continuously was in existence. He was there, and he was continuously face to face with the God, and he was just a character and quality himself, God. He was deity, equal with the Father. You have two persons there, and 1 John does that. It doesn't have the article, and so it emphasizes the quality of a garden. Well, we come back over to Genesis 1:1. And again, I'm adding some verses in some of this, in Genesis 1:1, but it says, "In a beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." And so when he did that, he created the heavens and the earth. And the earth came to be, it became. When it says it wasn't that way when he created it, and the verb has the idea, became, without form. And so it became waste, is the idea, without form. And it was void, that is, it was empty. And darkness was upon the face of the deep. And so, and the Spirit of God moved or brooded upon the face of the waters. And so when you look at this, we move on. When God created the heavens and the earth, they were without form and void. So there was some, it says here, it says they were with, they became without form, and they were void. But I want to take you over to the book of Isaiah 45, and we'll see how God created the heavens and the earth. When he created, was it without form and without void? Is he referring to the creation when it became without form and void? Was the heaven, were the heavens and the earth without, were they waste, were they empty? And so we'll take a look at that in Isaiah 45 and verse 18. And this does give a comment that goes back to Genesis 1:1. And so there was a space of time, there was a gap between 1 and 2, but it says, "For thus saith Jehovah that created the heavens," Isaiah 45 and verse 18. God himself, Elohim himself, that formed, fashioned the earth and made it. He fabricated it. He hath established it. He created it not vain. And so the word vain here, he didn't create it empty. And so without form and void, this is the word that he didn't do it empty. He fashioned it. He formed it to be inhabited. And so he says, "I am Jehovah and there is none else." But when he created it, he didn't create it so that it was vain, so that it was empty. He didn't create it in that way. And so we can see that in between there, that God created when he created the heavens and the earth, there was a time when he created spirit beings. And at that time when he created spirit beings, Satan was created. And in that day, he walked up and down on the earth before it came to be without form and void before that time. And it was, it was not created as it's described. It became that way in verse 2 of Genesis 1, became without form and void. And so it came to be. It wasn't at first waste and empty, but it came to be that way. And so before, there was a place that was already called Eden, and that's where God planted a garden. He put a garden there, and that's where he placed Adam, after Adam was created. Now, as we come over to back to Ezekiel 28, we see, we've seen this, that God put the Garden of Eden. It was eastward in Eden. Eden was already a place. It was already there back in Genesis chapter 2. Now, as we come back to Ezekiel 28 and verse 13, we just read through it, and you see all of these descriptions. Now, if you were a rock collector, this would be an interesting study. I do have some ideas and some of the ways that these terms describe stones. Some of them are not real sure, but most of them are. We can correlate them to stones that we know today. But some of them are a little questioned. We don't know. The last clause, "the workmanship of thy tabrets and thy pipes," I'm not sure what that, that's kind of not real clear what he's referring to there anyway. And so, but it was in the day that he was created. And so when he was created, though, he was in Eden, the garden of God. And so this was not the garden of Eden where Adam was and Eve was, but this is a mineral garden, a rock garden. And so it had some beautiful things and coverings that Satan as a spirit being had. Those were the things that overshadowed him. And so he would have these flashing stones overshadowing him there in this garden. So he was overshadowed by stones, we said. But you notice we also read that he walked in the midst of the stones of fire. And so these were flashing, firing stones that he walked in this amongst in this garden as the anointed cherub, first of all. But then he was also the overshadowing cherub. And so, as we pointed out, he was in the mountain of God, that is, in the mountain of God's government. He was involved with that, not a physical mountain as such, but it does have a look at something with an elevation in government, his rule. And so it's not a reference, we say, to a material geographical location here. And so this was not, the rock garden was not up on a mountain someplace. In fact, when some of these things, when we get down to reading about Satan later on, in the tribulation, and moving on towards the after the tribulations, they're going to be leveled anyway. The physical mountains will be, but at this time, he's not referring to that. But a mountain is God's authority, his government. And we pointed that out back in Psalm 2 and verse 6 with Christ and his place in his rule. And so it does deal with government. Now, when we come to the Mount of God, we want to take a look at some references that do deal with the Mount of God. We won't exhaust the subject by any means, but if you go with me back to Isaiah chapter 2, and Isaiah chapter 2 does describe how people will come up to the Mount of God in the future. And so that's Isaiah chapter 2, and we'll look at 2 and 3. And it shall come to pass in the end of days, we could say, the last days, the end of days, that the mountain, singular, of Jehovah's house shall be established. Where will it be established? In the top of the mountains. And so God's government, it's going to be over all the governments on earth. That sounds a little bit like the rule of the heavens over the earth. In Matthew's gospel, when he refers to the kingdom of the heavens, the rule of the heavens over the earth, but he says it's going to be, that his mountain will be established in the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all the nations shall flow unto it. And so they will be involved with the government of God. And many people shall go and say, come ye and let us go up to the mountain of Jehovah, to the house of God, the Elohim of Jacob, and he will teach us of what his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth not the law, not the Mosaic law, but a quality of a law. And so this will be a different law than the Mosaic law, and the word of Jehovah from Jerusalem. And so this is going to be anticipating the millennial kingdom, when they will come up to the house of God, and they will come to learn his ways, to learn his law for the kingdom. And but it says, for out of Zion shall go forth the law. That would be, I believe that's a reference. Zion oftentimes in these contexts looks at the New Jerusalem, where God the Father and God the Son will be at the pinnacle of the New Jerusalem, and they will be the light of the Lamb will be the light of the city, and he will lighten the earth. And so you have a reference here, though, to mountain and mountains, looking at governments and kingdoms and such. Now, over Daniel chapter 2, we have a reference again, and we see when we come to the interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, we do see that it deals with kingdoms when it speaks of a mountain. And so in 2:35, Daniel chapter 2 and verse 35, Nebuchadnezzar had this dream about this great image. We won't read that all of it, but just says, then was the iron, the clay, and the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them, and the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. And so you have this image representing various kingdoms, and then you have a stone which comes and smites the mountain and becomes a great it fills the earth, but it's a great mountain that fills the earth. And so this looks forward to a kingdom. And so it's a kingdom government. And so Daniel will give him the interpretation of this. Now, we're just dealing with the mountain of God and what's represented there. And we go down to verse 42. In fact, between 41 and 42, you have a gap here, and this would be where the dispensation of grace fits in. This is where we are today. But now it goes on to describe what will happen with the image, these governments. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And so it's going to be a brittle kind of a thing. The kingdoms are, the kingdom will be as it's going to be destroyed. And then I'm going to skip on down to verse 44. And in the days of these kings, you have the kings now represented in, by the image, shall the God of heaven, the Elohim of heaven, set up a kingdom. And so he's going to set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed. And so this is the mountain that's going to fill the earth. This is the rule, a kingdom. It'll never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand. It says forever, it'll stand for ages. And so it's going to go on, though. It's going to be a perpetual kingdom. And he goes on to describe a little further. I think we'll stop at that point. But you see the great mountain that filled the earth and that destroyed the image, the kings and the kingdoms of the image. He's dealing with kingdoms. And so in verse 44, especially, you see God's kingdom that's going to be established. That's the great mountain. And the other parts of the image, these are kingdoms. And so you have these 10 kings that are left there that will be dealt with, and that's further into Daniel. And so this is the description, though, of a mountain. It's government. Well, Satan, that's where he was located, in the mountain of God, in the mountain of the holiness of God. And so that's where he was situated, and he walked up and down in the stones of fire in this garden referred to, this rock garden called Eden. Now, when we look at his kingdom, goes not just to the earth here, but it does cover up into the second heaven, and so up into the starry spaces. Where spirit beings are, he was over all of the spirit beings who are referred to as the sons of God, as we noticed back in Job. And if you needed to see, you could see that back there in Job. We'll maybe take a look back there if we get there tonight. But anyway, this is the government that covers the second heaven and the earth anyway. Now, Satan, we see that he lost his overshadowing position and his place in God's government. And you can see that in verses 16 and 17. It was the result of his sin. And so he did sin. He did something, but he was lifted up with pride, as we'll see in verse 17. But let's go to verse 16. By the multitude of thy merchandise, he was into business here, they have filled the midst of thee with violence, and thou hast sinned. And so we see that he sinned. Therefore I will cast thee as disgraced, profaned, as disgraced out of the mountain of God. So now he's going to be cast out of God's government. And so we'll see that he's going to try to set himself up. That was something he wanted to do, to put himself up there above God. And I will destroy thee, O overshadowing cherub. But he's going to be destroyed from the midst of the stones of fire where he walked up and down in this rock garden, this mineral garden. Thine heart, the thing that got him was, what got him? Well, he was beautiful. It came down to, he was prideful. And so thine heart was lifted up. And so right there, he offended God. This is where we would say this is where he trespassed against God, because his heart was lifted up. Now in his heart, this was the inner being of the spirit being, not the same as us, but that it would be his mind, within his mind and how it functioned. But thine heart was lifted up because of thy beauty. And so there wasn't really any reason for him to be lifted up because of his beauty, because what did he do to have this beauty? God created him. And so God created him with this beauty. And so it wasn't something he had any reason to be proud of and to be become lifted up in his heart over it, but he was. And so the moment that he did that, he offended God by that, and that's when he moved off into the realm of unrighteousness. He was unrighteous when his heart was lifted up. And in the previous verse, we see that he had sinned, but this was what brought him to his sin. But he says, thou hast corrupted, you've polluted your wisdom by reason of thy brightness. And so you see here, he had brightness. Now he was covered. It says that he was overshadowed with stones, bright flashing stones. But here it speaks of his brightness. He was covered with something of brightness like light. And so there was a brightness here, but he polluted. He polluted his wisdom because it was polluted because of his brightness and his beauty. So notice what God says to him, I will cast thee to the ground. I will lay thee before kings and that they may behold thee. And so in the middle of the tribulation, he is going to be kicked out of heaven. But at this point, he still has access. He did have access in Job's day after the fall. In Job chapter 1, we'll go back and notice that when we look at his fall and such. But let's just go back and take a look at it now because I'll probably forget otherwise. But let's go back to Job 1 for a moment. This is not in your notes, but it's very applicable to what we're looking at this point. And so Job chapter 1 and verse 6. Now, there came to be a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before Jehovah, and Satan came also in the midst of them. And so Satan was right in the middle of the sons of God. Sons of God is a reference to in the Old Testament. It looks at those who are spirit beings. And so Satan, a fallen spirit being, a cherub, comes in with other sons of God in a day when they came to present themselves before Jehovah, and God carries on a conversation with Satan. Now, over in chapter 2, verse 1, again, there came to be a day again when the sons of God came to present themselves before Jehovah, and Satan came also among them to present himself before Jehovah. And so again, God carries on a conversation with Satan. Both conversations involve Job. And so did Satan consider Job? And so these are times when he was able to go in before God, along with other sons of God. And so we see, though, he is going to be booted out of heaven, and that's something that will take place in the future. But as we look at it, this was a result of his sin. He says, I will cast thee to the ground. I will lay thee before kings that they may behold thee. But this is looking at his judgment when he's going to be booted out of heaven. Now, the next thing now we move on to is Satan's sin and the resultant fall. And as we move on to his sin and the resultant fall, we will take a look at the reason for Satan's sin first of all. And so we're still in Ezekiel 28, and we look at verse 15. We've been passing by 15, working around it, but it says in verse 15, it says perfect. They like to translate the word perfect, but he was all that a spirit being could be in those days. He had integrity. And sometimes this term is translated integrity, but you were perfect. You were in the sense that you had integrity. You were all that you could be in thy ways and your lifestyle from the day that thou was created. And so when God created him, He was what he should have been. And his actions, his lifestyle, was what it should have been. It's the anointed, overshadowing cherub. He was everything he should have been. But then notice the rest of the verse, though, till crookedness, dishonesty, that is, the word iniquity, was, and I will say this, when we cover these terms, when we go through the doctrine of sin, and unrighteousness would be the better term to title the course, but iniquity in both testaments translates all kinds of words. And so it really doesn't mean anything when you look at it. But this word, it has the idea of crookedness, dishonesty. Now, in other places, we'll notice places it's often used of man, of the sin nature, perversity, a different word, a different letter at the beginning, and quite different than this. A little different, it's a different spelling than this. But this is crookedness. Dishonesty was found in thee. And so he was all that he should have been in all of his ways, all of his lifestyle, how he lived as a created spirit being, as he did what he was placed to do in this rock garden. He overshadowed there. He did his job, and he did what was right. He wasn't necessarily righteous, but he was all that he was supposed to be, we could say. And so that's where he is found now. He was, but there was dishonesty, there was crookedness found in him. Now for this cause, this was the cause for Satan's crookedness and sin. What was that? It was his pride. And so when we noticed that, his heart was lifted up. And so that was when pride took over within the heart of Satan. And that was the thing that got to him. Now, I mentioned the word perverse, and it does pop up twice in verse 18. And it's again translated iniquity and iniquities. It's a different word than we saw up there in verse 15, where it was crookedness. But here it says, thou hast defiled thy sanctuaries by the multitude of thy perversities, by the perversity of thy trafficking. Therefore will I bring forth a fire from the midst of thee. Now he's not speaking of a flame of fire here so much as he is speaking of passions. And oftentimes you find fire used to describe the burning sensations, burning anger. These I would say are probably describing God in the terms of man, kind of like anthropomorphisms, dealing with God and in describing him as having hands and feet and arm and so forth, when he is a spirit being. But when you look at this kind of a concept, God has burning anger. We do have some references to that. At times he's burning with jealousy. God is describing God's not pleased with what's going on. And that's in Psalm 79 and verse 5. Again, not in your notes, just fill in a few things here dealing with it. And he has wrath, he's burning wrath in Psalm 89, 46. And then he has burning anger in Jeremiah 15 and verse 14. And so it's used in the sense of something of a passion within man. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 9 describes marriage and stuff, but it's better to marry than to burn. And so it's not used, that's not burning yourself up. And so to burn, in Genesis 44 and verse 18, when Joseph's brothers were standing before Joseph, I remember it was Judah who spoke forth that didn't want to see the burning anger of the ruler of Egypt, but it's used in those ways. And so this is I'll bring forth a fire from the midst of thee. He's going to have some passion from within him, and it shall devour thee. He'll be eaten up by it. by the passion within him, and I will bring thee to ashes upon the earth. So he's not literally going to be a pile of ashes. We do take scripture literally, but this is describing something of a spirit being. But he's going to be brought to ashes upon the earth in the sight of all them that behold thee. And so, but he's going to be judged. He's going to be, as he's kicked out of heaven and have no more access to God. That is something that will take place. But when we consider Job, how do I get back to Job all of a sudden? I just popped back there. But anyway, he was lifted up because of his sin and his pride. God's going to deal with him. And so he came to have perverseness. And so when it speaks of perverseness, he had a bent. Now when Adam sinned, before he sinned, when he offended God with a trespass, Adam died spiritually. When he died spiritually, there was a separation from God, and he had a bent, and so he had a bent to sin. We refer to it as the sin nature. Well, when Satan fell, he also had a bent, and his bent was to sin, and he did sin. But when he was lifted up in his heart, because of his beauty, he was proud, and because of that, he did sin, though he carried out action later on in what he did. But it was his sin that got him. He fell when he, we could say that he fell with his trespass when he was lifted up, but it resulted in a sin, an act of sin. And so he came to have perverseness, as we just saw in verse 18. Now we pointed out back in verse 16 that he sinned, and thou hast sinned in the middle of the verse. And we want to go back to the New Testament for just a moment. We'll go back to 1 John chapter 3. In 1 John chapter 3, John describes what it is, how you can distinguish those who are the born ones of God versus those who are Satan's children. And as we look at verse 8, it says, he that committeth sin is out from the devil. Now I want to go back just for a minute and comment on committeth. It isn't that you just commit one sin and you're out from the devil. It's a present tense, comes from the verb to do or to make. And it would be describing somebody who makes it a practice. It's a habit. And so I like to translate this, and this would be the way you can translate the present in a situation like this. This would be something that was a habitual thing. So we could say the one habitually doing sin is out from the devil. And so he makes it a practice. It's a habit, a habitual thing, not just one sin. Because we all sin. That would put us all into that category if it was just committing a sin. But he habitually, and it's a present participle, he keeps on doing sin. He habitually does sin. Well, it says he is out from the devil. For the devil, what does he do? Notice the next word. He sinneth. And so the New Testament term for sin, it correlates to kata, the old Hebrew term for sin. This is hamartia, or hamart. I got my tongue twisted. It's the verbal form. And he sins, though. And what does he sin from? A quality of a beginning. So again, it's not the beginning, at the very beginning. But there were beginnings before this, but that at a beginning, there was a beginning when the devil sinned. For this purpose, the Son of God was manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil. And so we find the devil in the context, but we come here just to see John's comment by the Holy Spirit that the the devil sins. He sins. And so his children follow him and practice what he did. And it becomes a habitual kind of a thing. Now, this seems like I'm forgetting something here, but I have to pause for a moment. Yeah, okay, well, when it says that the devil sins, I haven't got there yet. That seemed like I was forgetting something. I guess I'm not. I'm just not there yet. We'll go back to Isaiah 14. I didn't want to. We'll come back to Ezekiel 28 in a moment. Just let me make sure. Okay, I'm going to. I think I'll do that here now, and we'll come back to it. But this goes back to Satan's sin. And what he has done probably comes up later in the notes. But when I'm still in Ezekiel 28, and I didn't touch on by the multitude of thy merchandise, they have filled the midst of thee in verse 16 with violence, and so on. And then you have down in verse 18, thou hast defiled thy sanctuaries by the multitude of thy perversities, by the perversity of thy trafficking. And so he is, with Satan's fall, Satan had to sell some goods. And I just kind of passed over that. And that's what I was thinking about. I didn't think of, and I'm not sure if I wanted to pick it up, but I'll pick it up here. What he does here, and we'll pick it up later on if we come across it. But when it says, the multitude of thy merchandising, he was up to something. And when you consider Satan, we can take Satan back over to John chapter 8 and verse 44. We'll be in this verse again, Lord willing. It's an important verse dealing with Satan's lust and such. But the Lord speaking here to the Jewish leaders, and we'll just jump right in here. You are out from your father, the devil. So the devil is their father. They claim to have Abraham as their father, back up in the context in verse 39. But you are out from your father, the devil. That would really make them happy. And the lusts, the strong desires, the lusts belonging to your father or from your father, you are desirously willing to do. And so the word will there, it's not predicting they will do it, but it's thelo, to desire, to desirously will something. So they want to do the lust of their father, the devil. He was a murderer from a quality of a beginning again. And so this goes back to a quality of a beginning. Now, this is where he was a murderer. Well, who was around for him to murder from a beginning? Well, this would be looking at drawing other spirit beings to follow him. And so they fell with him, but he had to sell a bill of goods to them to follow him instead of following God. And so, and abode not in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaketh the lie, and it's this articular here, the lie, he speaketh of his own, for he is a liar and the father of it. But notice, he was a murderer from the beginning. Now, I'll take you on over to Revelation chapter 12. And I know we touched here. These are not in your notes, again. Just don't get worried. Just follow along. You'll have to write them down, but Revelation chapter 12 and verse 4. Verse 3 speaks of the great red dragon, who we pointed out last week. In verse 9 is the old serpent, the devil, and Satan. And so as we come to verse 4, though it says, and his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven, and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. But then going over to verse 7, we see that Satan, the devil, the dragon, he has a battle. He has a campaign, actually, war campaign with Michael the archangel and his angels. But notice at the end it says, and the dragon fought and his angels. So he has some angels. And the third part of the stars are of the heavens are spirit beings who were, as we saw back in Job, they sang for joy when the stars came into being. They shouted, the sons of God shouted for joy, but they would have inhabited the stars. And so he drew a third of them with him. When he did so, how did he become a murderer from the beginning? Well, he caused the spiritual death of a third of the spirit of a third of angels. Keep it in the ranks where it is. And so he did that, but that was, he was sold them a bill of goods to do that as a result of his pride and his crookedness and all of the rest of it and his sin. When he sinned and such, he did have an effect upon other spirit beings. Now we do have an account of his fall, and I think we'll just kind of introduce Isaiah 14. And as we come to Isaiah 14, we find his name. He was Lucifer. And so Lucifer, he was a bright and shining being. And so we see this. He's still seen here. He's been in heaven. He's had some along with the sons of God after his fall in Job 1 and 2. But it says, how art thou fallen from heavens, O Lucifer? So he'd been up into the heavens, but he's seen falling. And this would be about mid-trib when he does fall. But he's seen to be falling as from heavens. But he's Lucifer. And so he's the day star, or the shining one, is the meaning of Lucifer. But he's the son of the morning, the son of the dawning, as it begins to dawn. And so this is a description of him as that one who had brightness and all of that before his fall, but he's fallen. And his name was Lucifer. He was the shining one. He was the day star. Now, quite interestingly, you do have some reference to some of this when we look at him as the son of the morning. And it's used in two references, the day star. Let's go to Malachi 4 and verse 2. And this is a reference prophetically to God the Son in 4:2, Malachi 4 and verse 2. But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness, he's the Son, it's not the day star, but the Son of Righteousness, he's going to arise with healing in his wings, and he shall go forth and grow up as the calves of the stall. But this anticipates the coming of the Messiah to Israel. Then we'll go over to Revelation chapter 22. Revelation 22. And verse 16. So Revelation 22 and verse 16. And so the Lord identifies himself as the bright and morning star. It says, I, Jesus, have sent mine angel to testify unto you these things in the churches. I am the root and the offspring of David and the bright and morning star. And so Satan, he had some brightness, not like the Son of God, but the Son of God also is seen as the Son of Righteousness, the bright and morning star. And so he has that quality in him as well. But Satan, he lost all that God had created him with that beauty. That beauty corrupted his wisdom, and as a result, he fell. And so it looks like next week we'll come back over to Isaiah 14, and we'll go ahead and pick back up in verse 12 and look at Satan's fall and reiterate his name and so forth, and we'll see the things that he said that he was going to do. And so he has, and so you have four I wills there, believe, that he's going to do. And so that's what we'll have to pick up next week. Okay, we better close then. So, Father, we're thankful again for your word and the opportunity to look into it, for the revelation that you've given to us, even about things that we can't see. We do know the effects, and we of these individuals, of spirit beings, we do see the effects as they influence men, and sometimes we are in conflict with them, with Satan and his demons. But we're thankful again for grace and for the provision under grace and the accomplishment of your Son and his victory over Satan, and that through him we and in him we can be strong, and that when we apply the armor, we can. We do have a defense that we can use. And so when we do it not with our strength, but with the Holy Spirit's enablement and with the armor, we can withstand him when the evil day comes. And so we're thankful for that, because you get the glory from it when we do have victory over this enemy. And so we're thankful for that now. Again, thankful for the evening and for the opportunity to study together, and as we depart, just ask that we might have rest as we move on into the evening, and again strength to accomplish your will as we move into the rest of the week. Amen.